Welcome back. You're with Public Address Radio on Radio Live. Raj Patel is currently a visiting scholar at the Center for African Studies at Berkeley University in California, but his interest in Africa is anything but academic. Paul Deedy talked to him about land and food in the developing world.
The food system, one that's fundamental to our very survival, both in biological and economic terms, is hemorrhaging. Commodity crops are selling at record highs, and the sharp hike in food prices is being felt all over the world in some form or another. Worse still, the main causes, climate change, a huge increase in the world's middle class, and the mad rush for our dwindling fossil fuels, show little sign of abating. The way we eat and the global systems of food delivery are in for a massive shake-up. Raj Patel is an academic, activist, and the author of Stuffed and Starved, a book which his accompanying website and blog calls the story of the global food system, asking why there are 1 billion overweight people and 850 million going hungry, and asking why there are millions of people now fighting back. Raj says we're already in the midst of a catastrophe, one that we won't be able to shop our way out of. The West may only now be waking up to the problem, which Raj says gets its label from a bad economics pun.
Agroflation, or more usually agflation, is the term. And it just means that the price of agricultural commodities is going higher and higher. Rather sadly, it's what economists think is a good joke, because it sounds sort of like stagflation, which was a phenomenon that we saw in the 1970s. Stagflation, because it was stagnation and inflation. So the economy slowed down even though the prices were going out of control.
The last year has seen some ominous signs of the kind of unrest likely to become more common as food price increases and food shortages set in. Riots around the world from Mexico to Burkina Faso are the first major food riots in almost a century.
The last time we saw major food riots in the world was in 1917, coming towards the end of the First World War, and in North America, grain prices were going through the roof. And so people took to the streets, and they took to the streets because there was a gap between what they believed that they were entitled to and what they could actually, what they could actually get. And that entitlement gap is one of the major sort of focuses, one of the major reasons why people riot. Because, I mean, there are plenty of places in the world today that have it pretty damn bad. In Haiti, for example, you can now buy mud cakes. These are cakes made with margarine and salt and earth that are a substitute for food. They keep hunger pangs at bay. Now, in Haiti, there aren't food riots, but that doesn't mean things have got tough. It just means that people are in such a stage of desperation that they don't believe that what they're entitled to and what they can actually achieve are two very different things. They're actually quite similar. Whereas in places like Burkina Faso, like in India, like in Mexico, like in Italy, there is a gap between what people feel they are entitled to and then what they can actually purchase. And there's going to be a lot more of that, I think, because in so many countries, firstly, the rate of food price changes is creating this entitlement gap. But it's also the case that democracy is becoming such a fragile thing that there is no other way to register your discontent than by going into the street. The normal channels of democracy aren't working to be able to solve the problem of food prices.
So what's causing this crisis? Why is such a basic human requirement becoming more and more difficult to obtain? The problems are many and varied, and ironically, begin with a huge increase in global wealth.
When people get richer, they don't necessarily eat a lot more food. I mean, if your income doubles, you're not eating twice as much as you used to. But what is happening is that, particularly in China, less so in India for cultural reasons, that people are being able to afford more and more meat. Now, this has a very profound impact on the food economy because meat needs cereals to eat. Meat needs stuff to eat. And that stuff is cereals, that stuff is grains of various kinds that normally would go into the bellies of people. That increased demand for meat is certainly one of the factors that's driving up cereal prices. And that's certainly one of the big factors that's going to carry on influencing the food economy because people's incomes are not going down, particularly in India and China, but around the world. It's almost certain that this is a phenomenon that's here to stay.
In this way, some have even pointed out that global efforts to reduce poverty have inadvertently fueled the crisis.
I'd rather not say the problem with getting rid of poverty is that all of a sudden there are people who want to eat, because I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing to get rid of poverty, and I certainly think that that there's that providing people with the basic amount of food to live a life in dignity is something that we need to be definitely pushing forward on. But I do think that there's, what's happening certainly is a shift up, is what's called the nutrition transition, a shift from eating mainly plant-based diet to eating a diet that has more and more meats in it, more and more processed foods. And I think that the transition to that kind of diet is not sustainable for any country, whether it's rich or poor. And that's something we do need to pay attention to and to move away from.
The last time food prices spiked so dramatically was during the Arab oil embargoes of the 1970s. But like increasing global wealth, Raj explains that the present fossil fuel shortages also look very permanent.
The thing about the embargo in the 1970s was that it was a political event that was designed was specifically to raise the price of oil, and it was something that was done by constricting supply. Today, the spigots are being turned off just a little bit, but the main reason the prices are going through the roof isn't because that there's an embargo, but because there's so much demand for oil. And that demand, again, isn't going to go anywhere. It's certainly not going away, given how fossil fuel hungry our economies are. And that means that, as you say, that has a knock-on effect. And it's not just in the transportation of food. You're right, it's about fertilizer. Fertilizer is produced with natural gas, and the price of natural gas has also gone through the roof. And that means that what we're having increasingly is kind of unsustainable industrial agriculture that uses fertilizers, that uses all kinds of pesticides, that uses, it's very sort of intensive in its use of fossil fuels. And that kind of agriculture is definitely getting much more expensive.
Raj is also dubious of the promotion of biofuel as a potential saviour for oil shortages, noting their link to the food system.
There's a deep irony here. The reason, one of the key reasons that American grain prices have gone through the roof is because of climate change. Well, not directly because of climate change, but because of a solution to climate change. That solution is biofuels. What the U.S. government has done is create vast incentives for farmers who grow corn, who grow maize, to have that corn converted into ethanol, which becomes a sort of foreign policy goal and domestic policy goal to be able to keep America energy independent, even though it's ludicrous to imagine that America will be fueled by ethanol rather than anything else. And of course, ludicrous if you look at the carbon dioxide sums involved in ethanol growing. It's a net carbon producing thing. It adds more carbon to more CO2. Equivalent gases to the atmosphere than it does remove in terms of fossil fuels, but biofuels are a profoundly loopy idea. But they profit a handful of people and processors in the United States, and they've that the introduction of that policy has soaked up a lot of the American grain.
So, with such ingrained and monumental causes, an easy solution might be to look at population control. Raj acknowledges this, but says it comes down to striking a better balance.
There are too many people on the planet at the moment to be able to eat like Americans, for example, or to be able to eat like the richest people in the world. But there's certainly enough food around for everyone. It's just a case of how we distribute it and how we share it. At the moment, the system we have for sharing it is through the market, through whoever can afford it gets it. But that's a profoundly inequitable system because it means that some people on this planet can't afford to eat and can't afford to buy food, and they go hungry. It's important also to address the population issue, and I think the way to address that is to use the policy that has been proven the most effective, and that policy is girls' education. I'm fully in favor of increasing the amount of money that we spend on girls' education throughout the world because the more educated girls are, the more controlled they are when they become women of their fertility. It's a win-win-win-win-win all the way around. Having girls who are confident and able to take charge of, for example, of their medication or take charge of their finances or take charge of their lives, that's a profoundly good way of changing, of sort of redressing the imbalances in power that most women face. And it's a long-term solution, but it's one that has been proven to work.
The UK's new chief scientific advisor says the answer lies in getting lots better at growing things. But Raj cautions that more efficient and economical crops don't necessarily start with the letter G.
I think New Zealanders are absolutely right to be very suspicious of genetically modifying crops. But I haven't met a farmer yet who isn't interested in technology, who isn't interested in science. And farmers are, you know, the original experimenters. They're the people who created over generations the kinds of seeds and crops and food that we eat today. So definitely, I agree, we need a lot more science. But I disagree, and also I guess I agree with most of New Zealand in thinking that genetically modified crops are not the way to go.
Part of the answer might involve looking at just how much we eat all things bleeding. But as Raj explains, the real solution is greater than the individual and will require citizens to force political will upon their governments.
I'm not on any high horse saying, no, we must all become vegetarians. but I am saying that we should eat meat a lot less and a lot less often and be exposed to it. When we do buy meat, it should be considerably more expensive than it is now to reflect the full environmental and social cost of producing it. But that's not the only solution. I think at the end of the day, what we are seeing is a political problem, and it's a political problem in terms of development policy in developing countries, and it's an international problem because of precisely the elements of climate change. And this means that the only way we're going to get out of this is through concerted government action. And the only way that governments ever take action is when they are forced to by their peoples. So I certainly think that in addition to changing our individual habits and to be eating more locally and to be eating more seasonally, I think we need to be doing some fairly active politics as well and holding our elected representatives to account not only for the consequences of policies at home, but the consequences of those policies overseas.
Raj Patel talking to Paul Deedy there. After the break, we're dancing with DJ Recluse.